Welcome, friends. Melanie Hurlbut here with the Book of Obadiah, a short 21-verse prophetic book that packs a big punch. At first glance, its message is quite simple. Judgment is coming on Edom, Judah's neighbor nation east of the Dead Sea, for violence done against Judah in her time of judgment, 586 BC, when Babylon invaded and destroyed Jerusalem. And what exactly are Edom's crimes? Killing Jewish refugees fleeing for their lives, handing others over, likely for sale as slaves, to the Babylonians, and war profiteering to grab their share of whatever was left of Judah's land and wealth. And if that wasn't bad enough, Edom has shamelessly gloated over Judah's downfall, while arrogantly considering itself to be a nation too secure in their rocky fortresses and too wise in their choice of allies to suffer a similar fate. If there had been an internet in Obadiah's day, it's not hard to imagine Edomites posting videos of themselves killing or selling Jewish refugees while boasting about their war prowess and personal economic gain. And so, the Lord declares, "The pride of your heart has deceived you. You, Edom, should not march through the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor gloat over them in their calamity in the day of their disaster, nor seize their wealth in the day of their disaster." And in a classic tale of foolish, devastating sowing and reaping, what will Edom gain in return for its arrogant violence against Judah? "As you have done," the Lord proclaims, "it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your own head." God makes it clear that it was not okay for Edom to take advantage of Judah's tragic loss. Edom will reap judgment for their mistreatment of his people. To the surviving Jews exiled in Babylon, Obadiah's message would be a word of comfort, assuring them that the Lord had seen what has happened and will not leave Edom's misdeeds unpunished. But as we begin to situate Obadiah's message in Israel and Edom's history, we quickly realize that their story of injustice isn't a one-sided tale of violence and oppression. The history of these two nations that began as the twin brothers Esau and Jacob, both sons of Abraham's promised son Isaac, is way more complicated and fraught than that. Think U2's famous song, "Sunday, Bloody Sunday," and the 350-year-long ethnic and national conflict behind it. So much is said through the song's brief, understated lines, its driving beat and shifting, punctuated tempo. The infamous Bloody Sunday shooting in Derry, Northern Ireland, in 1972 was the song's impetus, but its core message doesn't focus on taking sides. Instead, the song unashamedly laments that Sunday's horrific contribution to the conflict's ongoing human slaughter. In a cry of pain, the song's refrain breaks with the tempo and cries out, "How long must we sing this song?" An agonizing cry for God's intervention, and an end to Northern Ireland's vicious cycle of bloodshed. And that's why U2's song follows its refrain with an emotional appeal, belting out the lyrics, "We can be as one tonight." U2's song is ultimately a plea to the two warring sides to find the way to become one, to end the violence and build a new kind of life together. This hope wasn't realized for another 27 years until the Good Friday Agreements essentially brought the violent troubles to an end. The Book of Obadiah is just as complex, just as understated, and just as epic in scope. The first half of the book denounces specific bloody acts committed, this time by Edom, against Judah at the time of their Babylonian exile, that, like a brutal boomerang, will return upon their own heads. In fact, all the violent nations will likewise reap what they have sown, Obadiah says, until they will be as if they had never been, destroyed by their own biting and devouring of one another. But remarkably, the second half of the book promises a deliverance from this endless cycle of destruction among the nations. In contrast, Obadiah promises that on Mount Zion will be deliverance. It will be holy, and Jacob will possess his inheritance. What can this future deliverance coming out of God's people mean? Obadiah finishes his vision, declaring that having experienced deliverance on Mount Zion, that those delivered by the Lord will govern the mountains of Esau, and finally, that the kingdom will be the Lord's. That's epic. How on earth is this going to happen? And what kind of kingdom will this be? Fearfully, we can't help wonder if Obadiah's message is giving a future delivered Judah divine sanction for an aggressive takeover of any remnant of Edom. What does Obadiah's message ultimately mean? These are tough questions from Obadiah's deceptively simple little book. To answer them, we're going to have to think through the book's context, three kinds of context to be exact, and unpack them one by one. First, the historical context. How on earth did twin brothers, sons of Abraham's promised child, become rival nations whose ongoing conflict culminates with Edom's shameless plunder of Judah during the day of Judah's disaster, and will end with deliverers on Mount Zion who will govern the mountains of Esau? Think back with me a minute into Israel's origin story. It's not pretty. The conflict started before birth. The twin boys struggled in Rebekah's womb. As adults, Jacob tricked his brother Esau out of his birthright and his blessing, while Esau, indifferent to God's promise through Isaac, sold his birthright to Jacob for a bowl of stew. Then, in danger, Jacob fled to his uncle Laban's to escape his brother's violent anger. Pause here just for a minute. Remember, this is Abraham's family, the family through whom somehow the Lord promised to bless the nations and redeem his world. And right from the start, this family is a mess. Years later, Jacob, tired of now being the one deceived, this time by his uncle, journeyed home with wives, concubines, children, and flocks, only to discover Esau traveling to meet him with 400 men. Jacob was terrified. Would he reap from Esau the violent anger that he had provoked? But then comes that super strange story in Genesis 32. Jacob, left alone to face the consequences of his actions, wrestled all night with a man whom he would not let go of until the man blessed him. At dawn, Jacob emerged with a new name, Israel, because he had struggled with God and with humans and overcome. In one of the Bible's most stunning turn of events, that very same morning, Esau broke from his 400 men, ran to meet Jacob, and graciously received him. Tuck that story away for a minute. We'll return to it. It is, after all, a strange glimmer of hope in an otherwise dismal tale. But over the next two millennia, when the brothers' descendants have become the nations of Israel and Edom, things got nasty. During Israel's monarchy, no matter who was king in Israel or Judah, there was almost constant war with Edom as the nations strove to dominate regional trade. Obadiah's spotlight on Edom's horrific treatment of Judah's refugees, like Ireland's Bloody Sunday, is just Edom's most recent gruesome contribution to the two nations' long history of warfare, retaliation, and slaughter. This brings us to the second context of Obadiah, the literary context. This little book of Obadiah isn't intended to be read alone. The scroll of the 12 minor prophets are intended to be read together, in conversational context with each other's settings and themes. Obadiah's vision is sandwiched between Amos and Jonah. Amos ends his book of judgment on the northern kingdom of Israel with a promise that somehow, through their restoration, the Davidic house will possess the remnant of Edom and all the nations that bear my name. But in Acts 15, at the Jerusalem Council, James quotes this passage in the Greek translation of this verse, saying that God will restore the Davidic house so that the rest of Adam, mankind, may seek the Lord, even all the Gentiles who bear my name. What's just happened? Edom and Adam, spelled the same in Hebrew, have become interchangeable. Edom has taken on a larger-than-life persona to represent all the nations of the world living outside of God's covenant with Israel. Amos tells us that through the promised Davidic son, pointing to Jesus, somehow God will save all the nations of the world. In spite of the devastating conflict between Isaac's two sons, God's original promise to bless the nations through Abraham will not fail. Following Obadiah comes Jonah's story. Representing Israel, a callous Jonah withholds God's mercy from wicked Nineveh until compelled to proclaim it by the Lord's rescue of him from a watery grave, all the while failing to see his and Israel's own need for that same mercy. Amos and Jonah pull on Obadiah and compel us to see the Lord's promise to Judah in exile that on Mount Zion will be deliverance as a reason for Edom and all the nations to hope. Yes, hope for the Lord's deliverance and mercy towards them as well. Finally, let's consider Obadiah's third context, Israel's covenantal context. What in the world is God doing through Israel anyway? Why do they seem to get favored nation status with the promise that Jacob will possess his inheritance? And given the history of the two nations' conflicts, how's that fair? First of all, the Babylonian exile, where the remnant of Judah hearing Obadiah's prophecy are, reminds us that God's people don't get a pass on sin. In fact, as they ponder their scriptures, including that story of Jacob facing Esau and his 400 men, the Babylonian exile will compel the humbled faithful in Judah to face up to their own covenant failure. And taking a hold of the Lord, their merciful God, this remnant will begin to wrestle with God, calling upon him in spite of their failure, to fulfill the Abrahamic promise to them, and through them, to bless the nations of the world. With these three contexts in mind, let's dive into Obadiah's denunciation of Edom's bloodshed and cruelty in the day of Judah's judgment, and look ahead with him in hope for an end to violent conflict and a deliverance on Mount Zion when at last the kingdom will be the Lord's.
Join us next time as we continue the journey, one chapter at a time. And remember, faith comes by hearing, and hearing through the word.